Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'm going to be keeping you company here on News Talk for the next hour or so as we look at some of the major stories here in Ireland and from around the world. And of course, there was only one big story here in Ireland, and that was, of course, the departure of former Taoiseach Leo Varadkar from government and from the leadership of Fine Gael. We're going to look at how that is viewed beyond these shores with some of our guests. And coming up later on today's show, we'll venture into the boardroom and I'll be looking at the curious phenomenon of why so few individuals hold so many directorships in multiple companies here in Ireland. And across the water, Rishi Sunak started the week with a warning shot across the bows of his party. But will he last long enough to pull the plug himself? Well, Mark Paul of the Irish Times will be here with me later to tell us what's going on in the Tory party. And finally, she's arguably one of the most powerful women on the planet. And today we'll be looking at Ursula von der Leyen, her life, her leadership and her bid for another term as President of the European Commission. Suzanne Lynch of Politico will be here to talk to us about that. And I'm going to be asking her about how the departure of Leo Varadkar was viewed by other EU leaders as he attended his last EU Council meeting this week. If you want to get in contact with us about any of the items on today's show, we're always available at takingstock@newstalk.com. I'm also open on Twitter or X at StockNT. Now, it's been in the news quite a lot lately. The role of a director of a company can be one of the most arduous positions in any company, with boards and the people who sit on them requiring an ever-expanding competency and skill set. But according to new figures, in Ireland at least, over 150 people hold directorships at just 25 companies or more. And that's despite the government already having some legislation in place to prevent this happening. So joining me now to explore the world of a director is Kathleen Gallagher, who is a journalist with the Business Post. Kathleen, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Now, before we get into all these statistics, we might just start with the basic principles of outlining what a director does in a company and maybe how the structure and the hierarchy works, and also what's the difference between sitting on a board and being a board director.
Yeah, absolutely. So boards are there to provide some oversight and strategic guidance to the company. So basically, you have the people who are doing the day-to-day, and the CEO is normally in charge of, you know, running the ship. But then you have people who are overseeing that to make sure that what they're doing is appropriate for the company, that it runs smoothly. And these really come into play with big decisions. So for instance, say I was a company and I was going to expand into the US, those plans would be brought to the board. The board would challenge me on that, make sure that those plans, they hold true, that it is the best decision. So they're really there to give a bit of an experience and sounding board and ask the tough questions.
So obviously, by the time you get to sit on a board, you have to have quite a bit of experience, one would presume, to make those evaluations and decisions and assess big questions like operational resilience, things like ESG, everything now from cybersecurity to risk management. So who are these people who actually manage to get on so many boards? And how do you acquire such a kind of broad skill set? What is the typical type of person who's successful at landing board positions?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're right. It's a very, very difficult position. What you often have is it's people who have retired from their major roles, but aren't quite ready to step back fully. So you see a lot of chief executives of big companies. They then go sit on several boards and give their expertise. And then you're right, you start to have specialists, and that changes depending on the environment. At the moment, cybersecurity is really important because of growing technology. So you see people who have spent their whole life in cybersecurity, they're getting positions on boards as well, people with ESG experts. So no one person tends to have all of the skills, but the specific skill sets gets represented on the board. And normally the chair of the board has maybe had a bit more of a senior role. So often was a chief executive of a very big company or had a very senior role at a very big company. So they have that ability to challenge.
So ideally you want to end up with a good mix of people on a board with a different skill set, albeit maybe in a particular area, but you want to have someone who has got lots of different types of experience sitting around the table, not just one group. You also, I'd imagine, want a bit of diversity to have society reflected back at you through a board. But just in terms of the onerous nature of being a board member now, is it a lucrative one? So, because there's lots more checks and balances that you've got to adhere to now. Is there a typical salary attached to board membership in Ireland?
Not that I've come across. I think it can vary quite a lot. So depending if it's a small private company, say with like, I don't know, maybe just 10 people or something like that, that position probably doesn't have a lot of money behind it. If you start to look at public companies, then they can get remunerated into hundreds of thousands potentially. So it is a very varied position, but you are nicely compensated for what is can be not a lot of your time. Recruiters say that you need roughly 2 days a month per board to do a good job. Now, some of the smaller boards, you probably don't even need to do that. So you are getting money for basically just your expertise.
And what about how they're held to account then? What are the checks and balances, and how is proper governance maintained and growing?
At a board level, it really, again, depends. Like for public companies, there is a lot of scrutiny on that board. You know, the investors, the shareholders, they can command quite a lot of change. And you see boards getting or chairs getting ousted because they're not holding companies to account. At a private level, it's a bit more difficult because there isn't that level of
transparency, maybe is the word.
Transparency, yeah. Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So it's a little bit more difficult. But again, you will have investors, be they private equity, be they the CEOs themselves. And so they will be putting a challenge to boards. But the governance there, it's a little bit more murky.
I have certainly seen more and more people are reluctant to go on boards because they themselves are, one, exposed. And two, we look at what has happened recently and the reputational damage that an individual can face if the company or the organization might get into difficulties themselves. So it's not just an issue of money, it's also the reputational side of things that is important really for people who are going on boards, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And as you say, it's been in the news and you see people getting quite personal attacks on them for things that happened at a board level. So it isn't something to be taken lightly.
If you're just tuning in, folks, you're listening to News Talks Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, and I'm talking to Kathleen Gallagher, who's a journalist with the Business Post, and we're talking about the world of boards and corporate governance. Now, Kathleen, you were writing recently about over 150 people in Ireland holding directorships at 25 companies or more. And as I mentioned in the intro there is already government legislation to restrict this type of thing happening. Can you talk us through what you found out about those figures and how you found out that there are effectively a lot of people who are on quite a number of boards?
Yeah, absolutely. So back in 1999, so quite a long time ago, the government introduced some legislation to put a restriction on this practice of overboarding. And they said people could only sit on 25 boards. Now, that number is very high already. When I was speaking to people, they were like roughly 4 to 6 is what most jurisdictions would consider appropriate. So the number 25, already quite high. FOI'd the CRO to see how many people were breaching that limit, and they said over 150 people have over that number.
Well, so just can we just stop there for a second, Kathleen? Because already our threshold is huge, right, when you compare it to other jurisdictions, and now there's 150 people who are exceeding that.
Yes, absolutely. And that's down to a few things. Now, some of this is quite understandable. There are companies that are overarching companies, and then they have smaller entities underneath them that don't really do much. So really, those are one company, and the CRO count them as one company. So you can totally understand why that number might get slightly inflated and why they wouldn't really crack down on that. But there are quite a lot of other exceptions under there as well. For instance, they don't count public companies, they don't count some investment companies either. So those numbers are quite high. And then even after that, they also aren't entirely sure if that's it, because they haven't been tracking directors' PPS numbers. So I could have directorships listed under my parents' house and my own house, and those wouldn't be all connected to me. So really, the CRO doesn't have a big grasp on who's a director where and who are breaching those limits.
And an audit or the governance of this, where does that sit? Does it sit with the company registrar's office?
So the company's registration office are the ones that would be kind of signing off of the appointment of directors. But they can, if they, you know, discover after the fact that, oh, this person is over the limit, they would be able to refer to the CEO, so the enforcement office. The enforcement office could then take action, but they themselves don't look at it. So you need that referral between the two. And it's unclear how that's happening at the moment.
And Kathleen, one thing I should have asked you earlier is, how does someone become a director? Like, are there qualifications that you need now to actually just become a bog standard director in any company, whether it's small or large? Or is it through contacts with companies and existing relationships that you have?
So it's a lot about connections at the moment, at least in Ireland. So it is kind of, you know, you went to school or you worked with someone before, or you were sitting on another board, and there is this pool, which is part of the reason you're having this concentration of people who have quite a number of directorships. There is a growing kind of professionalism of it. So you do have the chartered director qualification, which from what people told me is a very difficult qualification to get. And people that managed to complete that course, they are then in very high demand because they're considered the best of the best. So there is a bit of professionalization to it at the moment.
And could that have something to do with the overlap and a large number of people having a large number of directorships, that actually there's not enough people who have that qualification to qualify?
Yeah, absolutely. That could be playing a role as well.
Kathleen, where do you see this going now? Do you think this is going to be an issue for anyone? Or, like, even when you look at the issue of gender parity on boards as well, like, they never quite get there. I know that there's a lot of work ongoing, but is anyone looking at this to try and, you know, even this out, make this better?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're seeing kind of growth in recruiters that specialize in this area. Quite a few people I spoke to said they were trying to go towards recruiters a bit more to get a pool of different people than just those within their network. You know, the CRO, they have instituted this new policy that directors have to supply their PPS number. That's going through the system at the moment. So once that goes through, they'll be able to check that a bit more carefully. But there definitely needs to be more done, because that 25 limit is very high and there are risks associated with overboarding. It's quite a, you know, a hot issue. So it does need to be tackled.
And finally, Kathleen, do you think it's getting harder for people, for companies and for organizations, and we didn't even get into the state side of things yet, to actually convince people to go on boards?
Yeah, I mean, going back to what we were saying before, like, it can end up in the spotlight. You can end up being personally held responsible. It's a tough gig that's not for the faint of hearted. So I think there is this kind of, why would I put that pressure on myself? Particularly if you are edging your way towards retirement, you've probably worked quite hard already. Why would you then put yourself through that additional pressure?
Well, look, I do think it's a fascinating area, and well done for digging those figures out, because it's been in the news, but it hasn't properly been evaluated, to my mind. So Kathleen Gallagher, thank you very much for joining us today. That was Kathleen Gallagher, journalist with The Business Post.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to News Talks Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston. Now, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with the life and times of Ursula von der Leyen as she tries to win a second term as European Commission President. Stay tuned for that. You're welcome back to News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, last month, Ursula von der Leyen announced that she'll seek a second term as President of the European Commission and head of the most powerful institution in Europe. The race to secure her second term will take place against the backdrop of rising concerns of the war in Ukraine, Vladimir Putin's now sixth term as Russian president, and a potential return to the White House for Donald Trump and Israel's ongoing bombardment of Gaza. But who is Ursula von der Leyen, the one-time compromise candidate? And she's seen by many now as the voice and face of the EU. Well, Suzanne Lynch is the Global Playbook author and also the associate editor at Politico, and she joins me now to discuss. Suzanne, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Good to be here, Mandy.
Now, Suzanne, before we talk about Ursula von der Leyen, I just wanted to ask you, you've obviously been covering Leo Varadkar in Europe for many years now, and he was attending the European Council meeting there this week. What was the reaction to his shock departure and maybe his relationship with the EU during Brexit as you analysed it? How was he held in terms of his reputation there, and how did the news go down?
Yeah, look, it was big news here. The resignation of any European prime minister, particularly the shock resignation, does make news. So he was surrounded by media when he arrived to the summit on the first day on Thursday, and really reiterated to the audience there what he had said in his resignation speech about his reasons for leaving, etc. But look, he is a very well-known figure here in Brussels. The fact that he was prime minister twice means he was sitting around the EU council table with leaders many, many times. And also, I think it's significant, he's a member of the EPP, that's the European Political Party, the group, the EPP, that Ursula von der Leyen is a member of, the centre-right group. And he has been so for many years. And back in the day, he was a member of Youth EPP. He was a vice president and very involved back in his 20s, his 30s, in that European political group. So I think as a result of that, he had a lot of contacts, a lot of dealings with European figures who were to go on then and become senior in their own field. So yes, very well known here in Brussels. And as you say, Brexit was a huge moment for Ireland here in Brussels. I think it's interesting, in the last few years, Varadkar has been maybe less prominent, but that may reflect the changing agenda of the EU. So, you know, back when Brexit was the main topic of discussion at summits, he was the main man. He was the person people wanted to hear from. Now that's different. Ireland is a bit more on the sidelines, but you know, it's not as dominant on the Ukraine issue as, for example, some of the Eastern member states would be. So as a result, it does feel like he was a little less prominent in the last couple of years.
Suzanne, I'm always interested in someone like a little bit removed from the bubble in Leinster House here. Why do you think he left?
Look, it's funny. I was talking to people here, and somebody made a very good point, which they compared it to Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand, and that's the way they looked at it, which was interesting. That you know, this young crop of leaders, who would have got a lot of international attention. She did, Varadkar did at the time of their election, elected on a big wave of promise and change, and essentially decided they didn't, as someone put it to me, have enough gas left in the tank. So I thought that was quite an interesting perspective. People are looking at it that way. This is somebody who's quite young. And I suppose it is a broader discussion for all of us and how we think about this, about why people leave politics, when they leave politics. He was extremely young to leave this job at the moment. So that's the way it's been looked at. I mean, we know that Varadkar was so, his identity, it was just such a new symbol of Ireland when he came in. That it got that international attention and it continued to do so in a way. So it, for me, it was a reminder of that, that is part of a broader conversation. And there's been other young leaders like Sebastian Kurz was in Austria.
That's right.
Even people like Macron, who is still quite young now, he's not going anywhere yet. But, you know, there are quite a few kind of young guns here. And I think it has made people pause and ask why.
Well, Suzanne, turning to the matter, and thank you for that, turning to the matter that we asked you on to talk about, Ursula von der Leyen, I think she's such a fascinating figure, and I think very little really is ever discussed about her. So maybe you could kind of fill in those gaps for us and talk to us about her family life, where she's from and what she's like.
Yes. So Ursula von der Leyen, one interesting fact about her is that she was actually born in Brussels. She's a German politician, but she grew up here in Brussels. She went to the international school, which in fact Boris Johnson also attended as a child, although I think they missed each other by a couple of years. her father was one of the early officials, very senior in the EU back in the day. So she lived here right through primary school until I think she was about 11. And then they moved back to Germany. And she then trained as a doctor. Again, similarities, I suppose, here with Varadkar. She trained as a doctor, met her husband in the medical field. He's also a medic. They got married and she's seven children.
I couldn't believe that. Seven children. Yeah. And she comes from a large family herself, but seven children to have had the career that she's had is quite incredible.
Unbelievable. Yeah. So that's very interesting. It's very, you know, unique. There are not many politicians who have seven children, let alone women, female politician. But her father seems to have been a big influence, very well known as a political figure in Germany, tried himself to run for big office in Germany, but then did go into business. She spent a little while in the UK and then later for, I think, about 4 years with her husband when they had young kids. And there does seem to be a period before she really went into politics, that she did stay at home. You know, she did stay at home more with her children. And there were reports at the time she started getting involved in local politics in Saxony, in Germany, part of the CDU party, which is the party of Angela Merkel and that her father was involved with. So she starts getting involved there, and rural politics or local politics in Germany is slightly different. It's actually, I'm not trying, no disrespect to Irish local politics, but you've got the different Länder, the different regions in Germany, and they have their own very sophisticated structures. So she got in through that system, like a lot of the politics.
And they're all like kind of little federal states, aren't they?
Exactly.
Yeah,
That's the way to describe it. So she moves up the ladder then. But it was really then she became a bit of an acolyte of Angela Merkel. And she held, but she was, I don't know exactly what age, but this was quite late on in her career, relatively speaking. She began to hold ministerial roles.
Yeah, I think she only went into politics when she was in her 40s. And if I'm not mistaken, I think it was 2005 when she held her first ministry. So, yeah, yes. I mean, that's another unusual thing about her.
It is. And the person it reminds me of actually is Nancy Pelosi, who went in, I don't know, it went into politics relatively late, had about 5 children, I think, as well. So, it's, you know, really excelled in her career then as she got older. So that's she was in the Bundestag then in Berlin, and she held various ministries. So she was Minister of Family Affairs, Minister of Labour. But her big one she's remembered for is Minister of Defence. So she was Minister of Defence for about almost 6 years. Germany's first female defence minister. And very close to Merkel at this time. And I remember being in Brussels around that time. And she was, people say she was unknown when she was became European Commission president. But I don't really think so. I think she was beginning to get traction when she became defense minister. That's when she came on the radar. I think for people in Brussels, she was quite media savvy. She would come here for meetings. She'd go to NATO, which is also in Brussels. And she stood out a bit. And that was where she grew as a political figure, I think, kept close to Merkel. But it is true then, nobody really thought she was going to be European Commission president. It was a very last minute deal. And what happened was the EU have this complex, it's a new but complex system called the Spitzenkandidat, where the political groups are supposed to pick a candidate. They picked a candidate, Weber, another German here. But essentially what happened was when it came to the European elections, a lot of the countries, the EU leaders didn't want him as the head of the European Commission. And Merkel pushed her, but seemingly it was Macron, the French president, who said, we'd be happy with her. We think she's very good. And it was him that got her over the line. And then they decided 5 years ago now almost that she would be the candidate to become the European Commission president. But since then, as you said, then her star has just risen completely and she's become hugely high profile.
And in 2019, when she was appointed to this position, obviously none of us knew what was ahead in terms of a pandemic, a war on the margins of Europe and in Israel. What were the expectations of her when she came in?
Yeah, it's interesting. And she said it herself, actually, when she was reappointed or announced she was going to run again just a few weeks ago. She said herself, things are so different now in 2019. But on the agenda at that time, I think one of the big themes was climate change. You know, that she made that one of her signature policy achievements. The EU came out with this EU Green Deal that was really, really ambitious.
And do you think she was criticised for going too far down that road at times?
Yes, I think that's what's happened now. It's interesting seeing how things have changed 5 years on. Mm-hmm. So when she was talking about running again and she kind of did effectively what was a campaign launch in Berlin back in February, there was hardly any mention of climate. And I think the reason is that it's clear that there has been pushback from a lot of the farming vote, but particularly in Germany, particularly among her own party, her CDU party in Germany. She's keeping an eye on them. A lot of they're dominated by German business. They have been struggling with high energy costs. All of this, of course, emanated from the war in Ukraine, which no one could foresee happening. So she has definitely changed on that. I mean, the other issue would have been Brexit, obviously, was still an issue then. And so they were the kind of things she was campaigning on at that time. And the idea of having a German European Commission president, for some people, it was uncomfortable because only because Germany is the biggest country here, it's the biggest economy. And would she be too close to Berlin? Would she be, you know, not rowing the Commission's canoe and instead have this eye and ear open to what Germany wanted all the time? But what happened to her was that, which was interesting, that her own party, Merkel, lost the election then, very soon after she was appointed Commission President. So she then had a situation where there was a new government in the opposition. Germany's Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, is from a more left-wing party. He's Chancellor now. So her own party is now in opposition in Berlin. So she seems to have managed that relationship. I was in Berlin myself reporting late last year. It is very clear that German government are very happy to have her, even though she's not in their party. But that was an interesting dynamic. But yeah, it was really COVID then, I think, that was the big challenge then when that came around first.
And what about her stance on Brexit and the relationship now with the UK? Has she managed to, I mean, it's been very difficult to deal with the British government, I would say, full stop for anyone. But how does that relationship sit? Because that's obviously still very important to us.
I think it sits well. I think the key change has been the departure of Boris Johnson, really. People made no secret of that here, that they could do business with people, you know, if they felt they were being reasonable, etc. I mean, I think it was interesting when we had the Windsor framework deal that she, you might remember, she
That's
went
right, she
to
had
Windsor.
That, yeah, and then she had that statement, didn't she? That was very important to clarify the situation, yeah.
Exactly. I mean, I did hear some grumbles, and I suppose this happens in every political system, and this is part of the criticism of her here, did you hear, was that she kind of flew off, or I don't know, got the Eurostar off to London for the big announcement, whereas other commissioners or other people in the European Commission had been doing a lot of the work on that. So this is the criticism. This gets the criticism that's always levelled against her and has been since her time in the German ministries, that she is too isolating, that she relies on a very small coterie of advisors and she doesn't consult with her other commissioners. Now, this attribute can be very positive in that I think that's one of the reasons why Joe Biden and the US love working with her so much. She's decisive. She gets things done. She doesn't say, well, we need to go and discuss this for 2 months. She moves ahead. But the downside of that is that she doesn't always bring people with her. And a lot of the 27 EU commissioners, including her, after all, and they all have their different portfolios and a bit like a cabinet, you know, they expect to be brought in, particularly when an issue is impinging on their portfolio. But the way she runs the European Commission is that she, when things, you know, important things happen, she gets involved, her people get involved. Now, and they do get done, but sometimes some people find it frustrating that she's almost gone ahead with the decision without consulting anyone.
Yeah, it's like that saying, you know, if I want to go quickly, I go alone. If I want to go safely, I wait for others. Well, maybe that's a strength in some ways, and sometimes it doesn't work out politically for people. But she said that she wants to also bolster Europe's conflict readiness in her second term if she's successful. As a former defence minister in Germany, like, how do you think that's going to sit with the other member states? Will that affect her candidacy at all, or is that something Europe should be doing anyway?
I think she feels that this is something that both her own party in Germany and the German public are now behind, but also that's the way the wind is blowing in Europe. I mean, this is uncomfortable ground for Ireland, obviously, as a neutral country and some other neutral countries in the EU. But without doubt, it's going to be one of the big focus of the next 5 years in the European Commission. And this week, they've been discussing at the European Summit about how to fund more investment in EU-wide defence. So they're talking about maybe issuing defence bonds or using the European Investment Bank to fund weapons that could be sent to Ukraine. And that's an example. The European Investment Bank is kind of like the EU's bank that's based in Luxembourg. All countries are shareholders. The Minister of Finance sits on the board. So a country like Ireland is obviously not going to be in favour of using any of those funds for defence or military. You know, Ireland would be in a minority there. That's the issue now, that there are protections in the treaties that obviously Ireland doesn't have to do that. But that doesn't draw away from the fact that the EU is, most of the countries in the EU want greater integration in terms of defence. And what's interesting, an irony here, is that Britain, when it was in the EU, was actually against further defence capabilities for the EU because it felt that that was the prerogative of NATO and it didn't want the EU to dilute NATO. So now that Britain's gone to the EU, it's kind of allowed people to go, oh, right, well, we go ahead with it. We don't have a huge country like Britain now that was always sceptical of that. So I think she is in tune, to be honest, with what people are talking about here. But look, the logistics of doing this, getting everyone on board, getting the funding mechanisms in place will be a challenge.
Absolutely. I wish, look, she's a very formidable character and really fascinating one. And I think at one point she was tipped as well at maybe becoming a NATO Secretary General. So obviously, you know, impressed beyond her European role. But before I let you go, Suzanne, we'll have to do a little bit of crystal balling. Do you think that she'll be successful in her second term bid? Is there any competition?
I think she will be successful. It's not a complete done deal. She has to be backed by the European Parliament, but I think she will be. But I do think that the second 5 years may be a lot more difficult than the first. Mm. Now, she's obviously not taking a leaf out of Leo Varadkar's book and deciding to resign. But, you know, now you're going to get into difficult conversations about Ukraine joining the EU. You're going to be talking about new budgets. And let's see if she rises to the occasion, or is it going to be just that bit more difficult in a second term?
Well, look, as you say, things are not going to get any easier for her. But Suzanne, thank you so much for taking the time to take us through the career of Ursula von der Leyen. That was Suzanne Lynch, global player, author, and also associate editor at Politico. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Andy Johnston. Now, while we're all consumed by the news of Leo Varadkar's departure this week, the newsrooms in the UK were in a frenzy also with stories of leadership heaves and election speculation. After the break, Mark Paul of the Irish Times will join me to try and make sense of what's going on in the UK. Now, you're welcome back to News Talks Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston. Now, for our final item today, we're going to turn to our nearest neighbour, because this week here at home was all about one man, and that, of course, was Leo Varadkar and his departure as Taoiseach. But across the water, British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak isn't having a great time either. And some have even spoken about his own departure, and there's massive talk over there as well about an election campaign. So, to unpick all of that, I am delighted to be joined now by Mark Paul, the London correspondent for the Irish Times. Mark, you're welcome back to Taking Stock.
Yeah, nice to talk to you, Mandy. How are you?
Good. Now, before we start talking about Rishi, maybe I want to get your views on the reaction in Westminster to the news of Leo's departure.
Yeah, I mean, it was a little bit like Dublin. It was initial shock. I mean, you know, whilst Leo Varadkar was making his emotional statement on the steps of government buildings, Rishi Sunak was in the middle of Prime Minister questions in the House of Commons, and immediately after that, and there's always a huddle afterwards, sort of in the bells of the House of Commons between the press and the Prime Minister's office. And the very second question that was asked was about Leo Varadkar. Mm. Now, Varadkar over here in Britain is seen through a kind of a very, very jaundiced prism, and it's a Brexit prism. I suppose, to put it bluntly, there's not a lot of love for Leo over here in Britain, and there never really has been. You just have to look at, I mean, for example, the day after Leo Varadkar resigned, so you're looking at Thursday's Daily Telegraph editorial on his resignation, and the headline of that is Leo Varadkar is unlikely to be missed. If you look at, for example, within about an hour of his resignation, the Daily Express, which is a really, you know, pro-Brexiteer, very, very right-wing Tory mid-tabloid kind of a paper, it had a picture of a kind of very upset-looking Leo Varadkar, and the headline was "Brexit hater Leo breaks down in tears as he announces bombshell resignation." Mm. So there's a little bit of Schadenfreude about it, and Leo Varadkar, I think, particularly for the British media and by extension then the British right-wing political establishment, will never be forgiven for the stance that he took during the Brexit negotiations. They see Ireland and Leo Varadkar as personifying this obdurance, this kind of stubbornness of the EU and Brussels that cost them the perfect Brexit that they wanted, and they'll never let him forget it, I think.
Well, maybe it's a great testimony to Leo Varadkar and his negotiating powers and the fact that he was able to, you know, get one over on Boris Johnson and solidify the EU behind Ireland at a time that was really important for us in those Brexit negotiations.
Yeah, and look, I think that's a very fair and reasonable view. But again, I think the British press, and I would say in particular the more right-wing elements of the British press, I think would see it a slightly different way. I mean, if you pick through, for example, the Telegraph editorial on Thursday morning, that editorial suggested that as far as they were concerned, Varadkar's stance wasn't just, in their terms, unhelpful to the UK. They also said that it was unhelpful to Ireland. Because I think there is still this sense at certain levels of British politics that, you know, what's good for Britain is good for Ireland, and that Ireland should go along with these things. And you kind of think that this is a bit of a myth. Maybe the British don't really think like this at all. And then, like I did last year, you move over here, you spend a bit of time in the House of Commons, and you realise that a lot of levels of the Tory party, a lot of them really do think like that. I think for other sections of British society, Leo Varadkar would have been viewed as a bit of a liberal pinup in a sense. And there was a very, very interesting piece by Tom McTague in Unheard, which is a kind of a libertarian online publication, which was quite clear-eyed about Leo Varadkar. But it did portray this picture of him as a kind of a liberal pinup. And you know, whatever you think about Leo Varadkar and whatever Britain thinks about Leo Varadkar, they were certainly interested in him because within minutes of his resignation, and the story of that was the lead story on the Telegraph website, the Times, the BBC, the Guardian, the Express, and the Mail has stories on it. They all covered it, and they all covered it extensively. And they're very, very interested in who's going to replace him. I mean, I can't walk around the corner in the House of Commons without somebody asking me what my view is.
It's fascinating to hear how they've viewed it. I've spoken at length on this program to Will Hutton, the former Guardian editor and Observer columnist, about kind of this latent thing that still exists within the Tory party, and look, obviously the Telegraph newspaper, about, you know, the Irish, and that manifests itself every now and then. They manage to cover it over most of the time, but every now and then those type of editorials pop up because, we're not exactly in the place where they would have us. But anyway, look, we're here to talk about Rishi Sunak. So let's kick off with a little clip. Take a listen to this.
As I said, the comments were wrong, they were racist. He has rightly apologised for them, and that remorse should be accepted, Mr Speaker. There is no place for racism in Britain, and the government that I lead is living proof of that.
Now, that was Rishi Sunak trying desperately to move on from yet another race row that is just one of the many battles that he is facing. Mark, you might just give our listeners a flavour of that, one of many incidents that have happened over the last number of weeks with Frank Hester, and the comments that Rishi Sunak was making there was about forgiving him, and he had showed remorse, and that remorse had to be accepted.
Yeah, Frank Hester is the biggest individual financial donor to the Tory party, a very, very wealthy businessman who's donated at least £10 million, but probably up to £15 million, it has been reported, to the party in recent times. So he's really put an awful lot of fuel into the Tories' election campaign war chest. But he made these comments a couple of years ago, which only just emerged a couple of weeks ago, about Diane Abbott. And Diane Abbott is a Corbynite Labour MP, no friend of Keir Starmer and the Labour establishment. She's a black woman, a very, very prominent left winger. And what Frank Hester said about her, or what he was recorded saying about her at a meeting a couple of years ago, was that, you know, she made him want to hate all black women, and that he felt that she should be shot. Now, look, I'm sure he didn't literally mean that she should be assassinated with a bullet. Of course he didn't. But the comments were very, very racially tinged. And the problem for Rishi Sunak was that he didn't immediately come out and say that these comments were racist. And there were clearly racist comments. I think there was a sense of weakness around the Prime Minister for not doing that. He didn't want to come out and have a go at their biggest donor and a lot of senior Tory figures said, look, this isn't racist. He didn't really mean it. Until then, Kemi Badenoch intervened. Mm. Kemi Badenoch is the Secretary of State for Business and probably the favourite to succeed Rishi Sunak if ever there is a vacancy. And Kemi Badenoch herself is of Nigerian heritage and she's a black woman too. She comes straight out and she said, look, of course this is racist. And although she has since says that, you know, people should move on. He apologized, Frank Hester. He should be forgiven if he's apologized. But all of this, you know, it came at the same time as another couple of things that were bubbling around Rishi Sunak. And it kind of solidifies around this sense that the very, very restive right wing of the Tory party, they want him out. I think that's the long and the short of it. They see an election coming over the hill. They fear complete and utter annihilation in that election. They think Rishi Sunak is not the man to lead them into it, and they want him out. Now, it's a very, very small cabal that is agitating to get him out, but this very small cabal is causing very big trouble for him.
And lots of discussion about the possibility of even replacing him before another election might happen. What do you think the likelihood of that is, and who's driving that discussion?
It's the same cabal that basically has been nibbling at Rishi Sunak's ankles for the last while. The Frank Hester thing sort of coincided within a couple of days with the defection to the Reform UK party of a guy called Lee Anderson, an MP, and from the working class kind of red wall seats of the north of England. An ex-miner, a big, sturdy kind of a fellow. If ever you meet him, sort of fellow with hands like dinner plates, you know, he kind of shakes your hand and you kind of have to go for physical therapy afterwards. That kind of a bloke. But Lee Anderson used to be the deputy chairman of the Tory party. He was handpicked for that role by Rishi Sunak to keep a connection with working class voters. But Lee Anderson has defected to the Reform UK party, which is linked to Nigel Farage. She basically thinks that the Tories have lost control of immigration and issues like that. And that, in conjunction with the Frank Hester thing, really, really weakened Rishi Sunak's position at a time when for months and months and months there have been people swirling around him. Anyway, an election is coming this year, at some stage this year. Now, it could come, you know, as early as May, and much more likely to come in October or November. But either way, the Tories are more than 20 points behind Labour in most polls. And much more worryingly, I think, for Rishi Sunak, the latest Redfield and Wilton poll that I was looking at this week said that in the red wall seats of Northern England, very, very important seats for the Tories to hold, that the Reform UK party is actually on 16%, which would split the Conservative vote and, you know, could hand Labour and Keir Starmer a huge majority. You know, I mean, Labour would almost be set for nearly two terms in government from the outset. So there is this sense among the right wing of the party that if they were to change, as mad as it might seem, considering they've already gone from, you know, Boris Johnson to Liz Truss to Rishi Sunak, that they could bounce to another prime minister again before the election to try and staunch their losses. And a couple of names have been swirling about on that front.
So I guess listening to those figures there's lots of MPs who know that they're going to lose their seats. They want to stave off the inevitable for as long as possible. Rishi Sunak then is holding an election over them like the sword of Damocles. And just looking at a quote that he used earlier in the week, we're in the fight of our lives. This battle will define us. When the going got tough, when the polls were against us, did we dig deep and fight, or did we turn in on ourselves? So, you know, he's using that as a threat to them. But in your assessment of Labour, let's just look at Labour for a second. They almost don't need to do anything. So except tread water until the inevitable happens. Do you think that the Tories will implode before, you know, Rishi Sunak gets to deliver on his promises, like things like the Rwanda initiative, another new part of that this week, which is extraordinary. You might explain that to us in a second. And the economy coming good for him, the interest rates thing. Actually, maybe just start off with the Rwanda thing, because that's something that I think will define Rishi Sunak in the end. He's a little new element to this week.
Yes, I mean the Rwanda thing is effectively Rishi Sunak's plan to deport illegal immigrants asylum seekers who arrive illegally to Britain on small boats from France, and to automatically deport them all to Rwanda, and stick them on a plane and away they go, and they can put asylum claims into Rwanda if they like. It plays very well with core Tory voters and also with the working class seats up in the north of England, who are, by the way, you know, hundreds of miles away from the Kent coast where all these where all these small boats tend to land. But the legislation to enable that, the plan has been struck down a couple of times before by on human rights grounds by various judges and so on. But Rishi Sunak has come up with a new plan, which in January passed the House of Commons, and is currently stuck in the House of Lords. And it's going through what's called parliamentary ping pong, they call it over here. It's where a bill bounces between the House of Commons and the Lords until they can agree a compromise on the measures. And on Wednesday evening, a couple of hours after Leo Varadkar resigned and a couple of hours after Rishi Sunak was at PMQs, he lost 7 votes on this in the House of Lords. So it looks like he's not going to get any planes up in the air to Rwanda until probably late June at least. And by the time the summer rolls around then, if you can imagine small boats coming over the English Channel from France, the weather's good, the sun is out, the seas are calm, you get much more people arriving. And this is a big, big deal for him. It's one of his 5 big promises to the electorate, is that I will stop the boats. So unless he gets this Rwanda thing going quickly, one of his core promises to voters is dead in the water. Just to touch on something else that you mentioned Labour and could the Tories basically implode? And I suppose could Rishi Sunak just lose control of his party before then? Mm-hmm. I mean, what Labour are really doing at the moment under Keir Starmer, they kind of see it here as they call it the Ming Vase strategy, which is like the path to government for Keir Starmer is to just tiptoe towards Downing Street as if you're holding a Ming Vase. Try not to drop it. Try not to do anything crazy. Don't balance it on your head. Don't do any tricks. Don't juggle it. And just be really, really careful and don't interrupt your opponents while they're making errors. And that's where Labour is at the moment. But at some stage in the election, and it's the big criticism of Labour from the Tories, is that what are your actual plans for Britain going to be? Because at some stage, I think in politics, and you've been around politics as well, Mandy, long enough to know that at some stage, you can't just tell the electorate, vote for us because we're not the other crowd. At some stage, you have to tell them what you're going to do too. And I think we'll see a little bit more of that from Labour as time goes on.
Very interesting. I just want to go back to Rishi Sunak for a second and why he may be continually losing support of the Tory parties. I mean, just trying to compare him with Boris Johnson in this part of the cycle, where at least, even though Boris Johnson was making a holy hames of most things, he was electorally successful for MPs. They could depend on him to garner support. I don't see any of that with Rishi Sunak. Is there anyone waiting in the wings who might do that for them?
This side of the election, probably not. I mean, look, I suppose anything can happen in politics, but I think a lot of people, there's a sense of fatalism now has crept into the whole thing amongst the Tories. And you know, perhaps Rishi Sunak isn't to blame. I mean, when he took over in October of 2022, like, they just come out of the Liz Truss era. I mean, Britain was completely roiled. I mean, it was teetering on the brink of disaster. You know, he managed to settle that. He managed to bring in policies that didn't make inflation shoot up even more, and inflation has come down. He managed to get some sort of a deal with the European Union. He's been a reasonably competent administrator of the country in a sense, but he doesn't have that pizzazz of Boris Johnson. But then again, who does?
Yeah.
So Rishi Sunak's plan has been to sort of go back to traditional old conservative values and try and portray himself as competent and a reliable steward, but that just isn't sexy enough to win over electorates these days. And there's a sense as well that the Tory party in and of itself has probably gone a little bit mad. I mean, it's been in power for 14 years. And through that time, it has gone through Brexit, it has gone through the pandemic, it has gone through the recovery from the financial crash, a kind of a proxy war with Russia, an awful lot of huge issues that would exhaust any political party or government at any time. And the Tories have gone through those one after the other, and maybe they're just running out of puff. I mean, maybe it is just time for Britain to change government. It's a little bit like having that kind of toxic relationship with a partner that you have to get rid of, and that may be where the British electorate is right now. It doesn't matter what the Tory party says, they just want shot of them and a bit of stability and calm with Labour perhaps under Keir Starmer.
Well, to quote Paul Brady on that one, this may be the long goodbye for Rishi Sunak. But Mark, thank you so much for taking the time to go through all of that with us today. That was Mark Paul, the London correspondent for the Irish Times. Mark, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. Just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app. I want to thank all of today's guests for giving us their very valuable time. We do very much appreciate it. Thanks also to the producer of Taking Stock, John Fardy. Simon Keane was on research and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. If you've got any comments on any of today's items, do email us at takingstock@newstalk.com. We love hearing from you. Anton is up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and an interview with Ray Winston and lots, lots more. But for now, that was Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston. Thank you for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.